The readings are labeled "The Road Diverged." And in this set of readings, we've got one essay or a chapter from Eugene Genovese on the conservatism that unites people across the North and South divide. Obviously, this is about the Civil War. That unites kind of like the theory between conservatives both on the North and the South who come to completely different conclusions about whether or not secession is legal. Calhoun in the South and a guy by the name of Story in the North. We also have in this document the Confederate Constitution, or the Constitution of the Confederate States of America, which is really interesting reading, by the way, if you've never had a chance to look at it. Something by John Calhoun on the nature of humanity, where he insists that man is a social creature rather than a solitary one, and where he insists also that humans are inherently unequal, right? Hence the questions that I was asking during the last session. Do the founders believe in the equality of humans? And Calhoun is going to argue very forcefully, and I have to admit somewhat persuasively, that they are not. So we've got that in here. And then a somewhat lengthy section from Arthur Taylor Bledsoe from 1866. What is the year?
66.
Right at the conclusion of the war, on whether or not secession was legal. The title of the book is Jefferson Davis a Traitor, right, on the question of secession. So there's a lot of stuff here. Do states have the right to secede fundamentally, right? It's almost as if we're looking at the difference between Hobbes and Locke, which we were already discussing a bit. On the one hand, Hobbes would say, no, you cannot leave once you're in the system. There's no getting out because it challenges sovereignty. And for Hobbes, everything. Sovereignty was everything. Where Locke says, no, there are higher laws that you need to adhere to. And that if the government, as who said that if the government gets sick, that was a beautiful metaphor. If the polity gets sick, I knew it had to be Kevin. Anyway, Kevin said that the polity gets sick at sometimes and it sausages and lard, you know, something about vomiting. But it was really well said.
It was very profound.
It was profound, right? The question of whether or not you're allowed to get out once you're in, right? Hobbes saying that you can't and Locke saying that you can, as long as what you're doing is in conformity with the natural law, right? And if the polity has gotten away from the natural law. So before we jump into the question of secession, I want to talk just a little bit more about the limitations that were placed on the Constitution. The more I study about the South, the more interesting I consider it. A lot of things that I once thought were kind of slam dunks about why the Confederacy was wrong, and I am a Yankee, make no mistake, despite having spent a great deal of my time in Texas, but still. I find that there are some really interesting things that the Confederacy was saying, and some things that really challenge my understanding of what the nature of the relationship between the government and the several states is and was. So I want to start off by talking a little bit about whether the Constitution is a living document, whether the courts are working properly to expand the definition of the Constitution and constitutional protections and things like commerce. Is there a reason for, a justification for what seems to be an expansion of government as opposed to limited government that on its face makes sense in view of the way that the Constitution was written, and which the Confederacy probably would not have agreed with, and this may be one of the reasons, obviously, why they left. So, to start off, what are the limitations that are placed into the Constitution at the time of the founding? Kind of a large question. I might start picking on people to ask them directly, you know. Mark.
What are the limitations?
Yeah. How is the Constitution limiting federal power?
Well, I think, obviously, the Bill of Rights are all a negative on government. I think one of the biggest questions, and I'm not sure that it's a limit, but it's an ambiguity, and it's one that comes back to haunt the United States, does a more perfect union mean a perpetual union? And that, of course, is the very question that the Southerners raised. From the Southern point of view, and really from the generation that inherited the founding and then ended up fighting the Civil War, the whole question of the nature of government and the debate between North and South, I don't think, really turned on the question of natural rights. It turned on the question of history. I mean, in some ways, the Civil War
And the debate leading up to it is a debate over the history of the Constitution. And the argument, I can go into a lot of detail about this, but I think I'll summarize it by saying that Northerners and Southerners did not ratify the same document. They didn't think they were ratifying the same document. So the division, some of the divisions in the debates that we talked about this morning about the advocates and the opponents of the ratification go even much deeper than that. Even among those who supported the Constitution, they interpreted what they were doing differently. They interpreted the power of the national government, the new national or general government, as they would have said, differently. And it's not just a question of the North respecting slave property. It's a conception of what that government can do. And for Southerners, the states created the government by ratifying the Constitution. The states created the government. It was their instrument for Lincoln and the Northerners, and Lincoln makes this argument explicitly in a speech that he gave to Congress in a special session of July 4, 1861. The United States existed prior to the Constitution, and the Constitution merely ratified an existing union so that states could not then depart at will. The Southerners said, no, we created the union, we created the government that governed the union, and we reserve the right to leave it. So they go back to the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, that those reserved rights and powers can be invoked, especially if longer continuance in the union is harmful to the purposes for which the union was established, the protection of persons and property.
Okay, so, but in the Constitution itself, what sorts of things are there that are going to wind up, and this is to everybody, what sorts of things are there to limit the power, the federal powers that might have been disagreed about between the North and the South? Tiffany?
Addressing the general question about what in the Constitution limits the power of government, there are a variety of things beyond, in addition to the Bill of Rights. I mean, it seems to me that if you ask a lot of people today what portion of the Constitution is designed to secure your rights, they would say the Bill of Rights. And that's correct so far as it goes, but actually the whole of the thing, it seems to me, originally was designed to secure your rights, both the powers, government must possess certain powers in order to secure rights, but it doesn't. The Constitution doesn't give it unlimited power. What are the aspects of the original Constitution that limits the power of government that is much forgotten today is the whole notion of the enumerated powers doctrine. The idea that in Article 1, Section 8, we're beginning in Article 1, all legislative powers herein granted. It's not a blank check. It's only Congress is authorized to exercise those powers that have been granted to it. So those are primarily listed in Article 1, Section 8. And, of course, much of the debate in the 20th century has revolved just on the how expansive are those powers, and that's become a huge problem. But in theory, you've got in those limitations, and then, of course, you've got the institutional mechanisms. I mean, there's separation of power, and the checks and balances that were designed to ensure the separation of power were designed to prevent, especially the legislative branch, but not exclusively, from usurping the powers of the other branches or usurping powers retained by the people or the states. So it seems to me there are many aspects of the Constitution that are designed to limit the power of government.
Okay. Flag?
Just to follow up Tiffany's point, maybe this will be throwing a hand grenade, but it seems to me, too, that if you think about Madison and Hamilton, they didn't think that the Bill of Rights were necessary, right? They thought the structure was good enough to protect liberty, and Hamilton, I think, went so far as to say, if you start enumerating things that the government can't do, you're giving government ideas, so you don't want to do that. You want, and I think a pretty sound argument could be made that The Bill of Rights, in a way, lulls people into a false sense of security that they, we have these lists of 10 things the government can't do, so therefore the structure doesn't matter all that much.
Bob.
Yeah, can I give a slightly more balanced answer, which is that let's not forget that when the Constitution was created, it was designed to strengthen the powers of the national government initially over the Articles of Confederation, and there were some founders who wanted to abolish the states completely, such as Madison. I'm not sure if Hamilton did, but they had a rather expansive view of a strong national government, a dynamic national economy, a unified nation. And so let's not forget about the fact that the patron saint of this institution, Alexander Hamilton, I'll say this, he wasn't totally in favor, I'll say he was in favor of strong but limited government, but he was kind of a centralizer. And it was Jefferson who was the decentralizer and the anti-federalist, and so there was a split among the founders. But, you know, the first thing we have to remember is that they were strengthening the powers of the national government or the union over the states. And then there was a split between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists about how far they went in that direction. And Madison's original plan was to get rid of the states completely, you know, in favor of a consolidated government. So, I mean, you know, let's preserve that balance or that debate between the Federalist and Anti-Federalist view of the original union. Still, I would still say it's an instrument of limited government, not only in Article 1, Section 8, but Article 1 and Section 9, too, were specific prohibitions on the federal government are listed, but a bit more balanced than perhaps it was just stated.
And how about things like, and this is discussed in Federalist and in the Anti-Federalist papers as well, things like necessary and proper, right? The idea of this elasticity in the document itself.
Yeah, sure. I mean, although the way it's interpreted, that all necessary means to the ends therein enumerated, so that's not an a blank check for the expansion of powers. But yeah, there were some people who believed in a strong national government. Let's be clear about that.
Okay, Clyde?
Just to follow up on Bob's point too. I mean, Hamilton's argument, right, for a stronger government was that weak governments, and this had been their experience under the Articles, weren't very good at protecting liberty. Right, anarchy was a danger, and so it wasn't
correct.
It wasn't strong government for the sake of a strong government for the sake of centralization, but for the sake of liberty.
Given that, how does one explain what happens with the Alien and Sedition Acts, which are so soon on the heels after the ratification of the Constitution? What is on the minds of the people who are ratifying this? What happened with the what were the Alien and Sedition Acts, and what happened because of them?
Fear of the French Revolution and its ideas spreading to the United States, right? I mean, do you want a definition of this?
Yeah, just.
I mean, limitations on the power of seditious ideas passed by the federal government to prevent essentially, you know, the ideas of the French Revolution coming to this country.
In part, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, the Alien Sedition Acts came also at the at the end of a decade of really vicious partisan debate among the Democratic Republicans and the Federalists. And I mean, it's a pattern of revolution where you have a revolutionary coalition that breaks apart, except in the United States, not very many people get shot. You know, they don't start putting people, too many people in jail, and they don't shoot anybody. But it came at the end of a really vicious partisan debate, and this was a way to protect the government that was in power from criticism.
Okay. Yeah, and I believe that there were some newspaper editors who were jailed.
Yeah, there were newspaper
over
editors, and I think a congressman they were jailed for a matter of months. I mean, nobody was put in jail for years and locked away in chains, but yeah, they were jailed and they were silenced and they were censored and they were fined and things like that. So Matthew Lyon, I think, was a congressman from Vermont, and he was jailed, and then some newspaper editors.
Tiffany.
Yeah, I think I don't disagree with Bob and his. I didn't mean to give the impression that there was no regard for strengthening the power. I think he's certainly correct in suggesting the Articles of Confederation was a disaster. And a very nice summary of that in Federalist 15. There's a long list of ills that the United States is suffering that are, Publius is arguing, directly attributable to the insufficiency of the government. But I do think. There was a disagreement among the founders themselves And then again, that plays out in the 1790s. An important part of the dispute between the Republican Party and the Federalist Party was how strong does government have to be to secure individual rights? And that even in the 1790s, when you see James Madison, you see Publius becoming schizophrenic, in effect. James Madison becoming one of the primary organizers of the Republican Party and parting ways with Alexander Hamilton and the Federalists. Madison has a series of essays called his party press essays in which one of the essays is kind of a dialogue between Republican and anti-Republican. And what he suggests there is there's common ground. Who are the best? The title of the essay is "Who are the best keeper of the people's liberties?" Both Republican and anti-Republican are concerned about keeping the people's liberties, but they disagree about what their primary danger, where the primary source of threat to those liberties comes from, and that has very important consequences for how strong government needs to be and how it needs to operate in practice.
And what are those places? Where are the dangers?
Republicans suggest that the primary danger is the abuse of power by those in government. Whereas in Madison's characterization of anti-Republican, and it's really unfortunate that Colleen Sheehan isn't here because she's a far better spokesperson for this argument than I am, anti-Republican thinks it's the people. The people have too much influence, and so as a consequence, and Sheehan has a very nice argument about this, that Hamilton looked at some of the policymaking during the Washington administration as kind of an opportunity to augment the power of the government as a way of kind of trying to check the influence, the popular influence exercised in government. And so it had implications for the executive power and how the executive was to conduct himself in office. Hamilton favored a very strong show of force in the case of the Whiskey Rebellion. It had important implications for Hamilton's financial program. Even Madison himself is suggesting in this period in which he is characterizing the dispute as one that's perhaps fundamental in nature. I think one of the interesting things is he's still saying we're still disagreeing about how to secure the people's liberties.
Yeah, did you want to say something? So what about the issue of faction? How did the framers approach this problem, which comes up in the Federalist Papers, in the Federalist Debates? Another problem with the potential problems of democracy. How do you get around this? What do you do? Fire away, please. Pamela.
Fire away. Okay. This is not an expert, as you have just heard, several people speaking, but my understanding is that factions may be a problem, but they are also the result of liberty, right? The element of fire is air, the element of factions is liberty, and there's no way really to avoid them, and so in Federalist 10, as everybody knows, the argument is put forward that we can only control the effects of faction, but it turns out to mean we have to find some way to prevent majority tyranny or majority faction. And we are aided, as Mansfield brings out in his essay, we're aided in that, Madison says, by our size, by our economic pluralism, and also by the auxiliary precautions provided in the structure of the Constitution itself, which allows for a lot of backing and forthing, ambition on one side, ambition on the other, which somehow is going to work well in the end. And to me, it has, especially in light of the elephant in the room in with respect to the readings for this afternoon, the issue of slavery, that Madison seems to express a hope that the causes of factions in the United States will always be questions of economic interest or special interests of one kind or another, just so many of them that any decision that is going to be made will be a coalition a majority comprising a coalition of particular interests, and that, first of all, someone like de Juvenal, I think, would be upset by that fact. He seems to want a more high-toned picture of what goes on in democratic life. I mean, that he praises Rousseau's general will, for example, because no particular interests are supposed to be available there. I have a different view of that, but leaving that aside, they don't seem to be afraid of the contest of interests itself. True, it means that people will judge in their own case, that they will be biased, that where they stand on any issue will be determined by where they sit, but hashing things out in politics will all work out fine, as long as the interests are economic. Because economic interests, by contrast to, say, religious interests, encourage you to settle for half a loaf, to compromise in one way or another. But I think that what the slave, well, perhaps someone else will be able to enlighten us much more about this, but I wonder whether the slavery issue does not, as several scholars have said, point out the limitation of Madison's description of American politics, that in the end, not every issue is susceptible to being subsumed under the economic interest argument.
Okay. Kev? Closer.
Yeah, two points. I get, just to put two questions on the table, just to further the discussion. One is that I think it's right to talk about the self-understanding of the participants. That's why I don't like talking about the founders or even the framers or even Virginians in this monolithic way. There are three different people writing the Federalists, for instance. I mean, there's all sorts of differences of opinions, differences of experiences. I mean, Hamilton's experience, I'm sure, is colored by his experiences with decentralization in the Caribbean, right, and seeing some problems there. Yes, he has a more centralist idiom than Jefferson or somebody, but you can understand it given his experiences. They've colored his thought. He's seen certain things firsthand that maybe other ones haven't, and so we might expect him to think differently, for better or for worse, about certain things. This is why I, to throw a grenade, as when I tell students, I say, who cares about the Federalist? Somebody will say, Federalist 25, this and that. If you see Federalist 78, I'm like, no. I don't care. Who cares about the Federalists? If you want to understand what the participants understood the Constitution to be, I think this speaks to Mark's point. You look at the ratification debates, right? You read Farrand, you read all these ratification debates to understand what New Yorkers thought they were ratifying, to understand what Virginians thought they were ratifying. I don't care what Madison thinks everybody else thought, in a way. You know what I'm saying? That's parasitic on the self-understanding of the participants. That's the first order in understanding that the stuff has to flow from, I think. I mean, the Federalist is a useful accessory, but there's always the risk that the Federalist is seen as somehow the definitive commentary on the Constitution, whereas I would say the people that are ratifying the Constitution ought to at least be consulted, right, in some sense. And then you start to see the kind of differences of opinion. Not that people don't understand that there's anti-Federalists and Patrick Henry or something like that, but you know what I'm saying? It's often underplayed. In my experience, anyway, the conception that the people have when they're ratifying the Constitution, as opposed to what Hamilton said in some essay, right? So the other thing I think is it's interesting, if we look at the institutional stuff, I don't, you know, the U.S. Constitution's one thing. If we look at what's before us in the text, right, we have the Confederate Constitution, and I can just suggest, and people who are more learned or thoughtful about this than me can jump in, maybe we should look for how the Confederate Constitution tries to correct what it sees as excesses or deficiencies of the U.S. Constitution in the same way that the U.S. Constitution tried to do that to the Articles. So I'll just point out two examples, and there are other ones. There are plenty of others that might be interesting to look at institutionally. One is that as early as when is this that they're ratifying it, right? 1861, president has one term. There's an explicit provision made for one-term presidency, right? That looks like a pretty clear restriction on allowing the president to centralize power. That under the U.S. Constitution, really, until FDR, people are not as concerned about, right? There's a provision to add territory. You know, as far as I can tell in the U.S. Constitution, that's pretty dubious, and this is why Jefferson's in shaky waters with the Louisiana Purchase. So there are institutional things that we can look at to say, what are they trying to think through in terms of limited government? What corrections are they making? That's enough. One last thing on the question of secession. I mean, clearly it's important to think about. I mean, Norway secedes from Sweden. Singapore secedes from Malaysia. It's a big question in the EU, right? So, of course, in the American context, the elephant in the room is always slavery, right? But secession as an idea politically is, you know, more broadly applicable. So.
Okay, Jen.
So I wanted to suggest that maybe we're not looking at the Federalists to find out what these guys thought so much as to hear some reasoned arguments for particular institutional structures, which we can then take and evaluate as to whether or not those arguments were valid, whether the outcomes match what they thought they would. And one of the things that I think is actually really interesting about these arguments is the idea that factions would be sort of have their power removed by placing a stronger emphasis on the centralized federal government or national government because of the idea that they'd be further away from home and there'd be less specific and practical or interests that the smaller, you know, legislator up in Washington would have a more tenuous connection, I guess, to these sort of specific interests that you see in local politics. And that was the argument for a nationalized government. What's interesting is that what we've seen is the machinery or the institutional structure of the legislatures themselves have actually outpaced what I think the framers would have ever imagined they could have done in terms of being able to marshal their special interests up to the legislator that we have in Washington now. So I think that the framers had this argument for a national government based on the idea that it was going to help cut down on special interests. But in fact, what it's done is centralize the ability for special interests to impact law. And I think that it's actually a technology issue, right? There's a technological capability that we have now that they didn't have, and that this technology has actually changed the way that this institutional structure functions. And you know, technology and institutional learning, right? Over the years, the various lawmakers have developed all sorts of ways of getting around, you know, laws that are meant to keep them from being beholden to special interests. They have developed log rolling deals to keep it. I mean, if you think about how the Congress acts now, it's kind of amazing. You know, there are so many trades that go back and forth. You know, I'll vote for this if you vote for this, so forth and so on. And all this is done without any sort of legal contract, right? It's all done with just reputation mechanisms. And that's actually kind of amazing in itself that they managed to do that they hold to their words and whatnot. And it took some really a long institutional evolution to make that possible. But it's really perfected at this point so that the special interests have a perfect avenue toward lawmaking in the United States. And so I think that one of the reasons that we look at the Federalists is to remind ourselves, actually, that they have these arguments that we actually would now use the same argument for decentralized government. We would say that that's going to stop factions. And I think that it should remind us to be a little bit humble about what we know the effects of these different institutional structures are going to be, because the same exact arguments that we're using for decentralization or for more state control are actually used for less state control in a lot of these cases.
Mm. I'd also just quickly point out that one of the, referring back again to the elephant in the room of slavery, which we're going to have to talk about here, Jefferson wanted to expand slavery in the hopes that that would eliminate it. It's one of those crazy ironies, you know. He thought that they could diffuse slavery into the new territories, into the other states, so that it became such a minor issue and so diffuse, I guess is the best word, that it would then be easy to get rid of. And obviously that's not what happened. Matter of fact, quite the contrary. Mark.
Southerners had been complaining about factions at least since 1820, and maybe you hear some echoes of that even earlier. And their fear was, of course, that a faction had seized control of the national government, always a danger under the new Constitution. This was part of the anti-federalist objections, and was using the power of government to benefit certain interests, in this case, manufacturing and commerce in the Northeast, against another interest, agriculture in the South. And that argument was rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed 40 years before secession and Civil War. In the end, it was another faction, the Republican Party, that had seized control of the government and was going to use the power of the government to harm Southern interests. That is, of course, not so much to eliminate slavery immediately, despite Lincoln's protestations to the contrary, that he had no wish to eliminate slavery, Southerners didn't believe him, but to block its expansion. I mean, it was really over the expansion of slavery, rather than, strictly speaking, slavery itself, that the Union broke apart politically. But this problem of faction really was tied in with economic interests from the Southern point of view from the beginning. I mean, really, when faction became a problem, it was always a faction seizing control of the government to use the power of government against a certain interest to favor other interests at the expense of that interest. So that argument had been there all along, and finally, with secession, it was articulated in a way that broke the Union apart.
Quick comment.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Well, I was struck in looking at the Constitution of the Confederate States. Kevin was raising the question of what differences. And so if you look at their definition of the power to regulate commerce, it is filled with restrictions that are a confirmation of the point you just made.
Okay, we have Mike.
Two quick things. One, I have the mental idea that if we were redoing the whole Constitution today, it would look nothing like it did back then because of technology. In a different sense than you, it's buttressing a little bit what you said. It's that, it's a big, vast land area, very loosely populated, and it's hard to govern across a large area. So a lot of that sort of delegation and sort of things that look like limited government may not have been there. So I view it as a sort of economic good fortune that it was hard to govern over long, wide distances. I have no evidence for that. But the second thing is that you asked the question, is the Constitution a living document? And I'm going to go back to Hayek. And, we always invoke Hayek's sort of knowledge problem about economic planning, and I like to think about how it applies to the Constitution. So can you ever write down in a document a general rule, even if the goal is to preserve our liberty, can you ever write down a general rule that's fixed forever that's going to maintain that? And, we had very hard discussions last year about what does it mean for the rule of law? Can it evolve? Can it change as technology changes and economies change? We never came up with an answer for it. And I'd like to apply it to how we think about the formation of government, too. There's no reason not to think about it there.
Well, to go back to the question that Kevin raised then, although I want to come back to this question about the expansive nature of judicial interpretation. Kevin, you asked a question which I planned on asking as well, so I'll ask you right now. What did the Southerners think that they were signing on to when they signed on to the Constitution? What was the difference between the Southern viewpoint and the Northern viewpoint? And that's a sort of really hard question because it's asking specifics instead of generalities, but what's the deal? Why are the Southerners going to wind up being upset by this? And it leads to another question that I have written down here. Was the Civil War written into the Constitution? Was it an inevitable thing? Yeah.
Well, I think to answer your first question, what were Southerners signing on to, I would go back to what Kevin said, that there's no one interpretation, because the South was not unitary. And in fact, I suppose on a historical point, and my reading may be idiosyncratic or even perverse, I don't think there was a solid South until after the Civil War, because you have lots of divisions within the South even during the war. But I think in a general way you can answer that question by saying that certainly the slaveholding states, the states where slavery was very important, were convinced that the Constitution recognized, even if tacitly, and protected slave property. I think if there was one commonality to the Southern point of view, that was it. I think, though, that the differences probably were greater than that, though that one unifying thing became all important as slave property came more and more under siege. But even in the late 1820s and 1830s, when South Carolina fought for nullification of the tariffs of 1828 and 1832, no other Southern state joined them. And many Southern states, including many in the Deep South, such as Mississippi, condemned nullification.
And did so, I think, right up until the time of the secession. I mean, there were also people who were saying, no, we're not going for this, but we're going for other reasons.
1850s, I think you start to see more sympathy to Calhoun's point of view after he's dead. I lost my point. So
sorry. Was nullification, I mean, is this solely a Southern issue, historian?
No.
Bob? A technical historical point was I believe the word nullification enters constitutional debate with Jefferson's Virginia and Kentucky resolutions passed just after the Alien and Seditions Act. And as far as I know, I don't know if he coined the word, but he sort of put it into the constitutional debate. And so it looks like a hysterical overreaction on the part of Jefferson to the Alien and Seditions Act, which he pens the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, and that starts to look like the blueprint for the Confederate Constitution. And in that word is nullification with respect to judicial review, which he gave to the state legislatures to nullify federal law in each state legislature. Of course, it never got anywhere because it was such a strong kind of overreaction to the Alien and Seditions Act. But I think he's the one who introduces the term. I see someone nodding down there. Is that correct? I mean, that's my understanding. And it's a big, powerful word sitting right there. And then it, you know, takes on a life of its own and the tariff debates and all these other things.
Yeah.
Just a question. Is this on? There we go. Madison did not sign on for that doctrine. Is that right?
That's my understanding. Okay. Yeah, that's Jefferson's. Yeah.
Yes.
Doug Ambrose is in the back there. I can hear him whispering. He wants into this more than anything. Yeah. Right. The only person who might want into the conversation more than Doug Ambrose is Bob Paquette.
Why don't you ask them? Actually, we're
isn't
we're,
yeah interposition is Madison's
interposition.
Right. Jefferson's doctrine is nullification, and Madison is interposition. And correct me if I'm wrong.
That's right.
In other words, interposition, as I understand it, is that the state legislatures stand between the citizens and a law as something of a shield, whereas a nullification, I believe it's the people. Is it vested in the legislature? But the law is declared void. Right.
Special convention.
Okay.
Madison and Jefferson.
Right.
Madison directs them to the conventions.
That yes.
Being picked up by Calhoun.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. So, back to this question of Calhoun then and equality. How persuaded are you by Calhoun's argument that people are inherently unequal? And this is a really tough question for a bunch of libertarians, and I know there are some of them in here. But you know, it's so funny how the debates don't remain constant over time. Is Calhoun correct in his statement that people are inherently unequal and that, as he understands the Constitution, that idea is built into it? Jen, talk to me.
I think it's not a hard question for libertarians, but it's maybe too simple an answer for you. No, I'm not persuaded that people are inherently unequal, at least not, you know, before the law. Now, if you want to take this as a statement where people are inherently unequal and that there will always be unequal outcomes, right, resource equity, then absolutely it's persuasive. And I think that that is that concept is built into the Constitution explicitly, the idea that we have to protect the right to have unequal outcomes among people. But the idea that there are people who are incapable of governing themselves or leading or of making decisions in a way that will lead to the general welfare, I don't think is built in there, and I don't think is at least not controversial at all for me to say no, that this is not something that makes sense.
Okay. Mark?
Well, I don't... Again, my reading of Calhoun may be idiosyncratic, perverse, or wrong. But I don't think Calhoun was arguing in a kind of abstract theoretical way here, because when he argued for the inequality of people, he was really arguing against a certain conception of individualism and a certain conception of rights, that for Southerners, and Calhoun was only one of many who made this argument. He was among the more articulate, but he was not alone, that rights were not universal, that all people did not have inherent what we would call human rights, or the rights of man, to use the language of the 18th century bourgeoisie. Now, that doesn't mean that Calhoun was some kind of savage who wanted to savage people. People had rights appropriate to their station. They had particular rights, and those rights could not be understood in terms of individuals. They had to be understood in terms of the relation in which a person stood to others. So you were inherently social, and you attained your rights, your status, your position, your level of individuality in a whole web of social relations that involved community, family, and government was somewhere in there, but far down the line. So rights were particular rather than universal, and they inhered in your position and your responsibility in society. So the rights of a slaves had rights, but not the same rights as a master. And what constituted a good slave was inappropriate for a good master. Men had rights, but not all white men in the South had the same rights. They had to be property owners, they had to be heads of households, they had to have household dependents. So there were no universal rights that applied to all, even to all white men in the South. They did not enjoy the same rights. Didn't mean they were completely without rights. They were devoid of rights and could be savaged at will. That's not at all what Calhoun or any other Southerner argued. It was that the rights were particular and dependent on station, but more important, on this web of relations that I was talking about. You understood yourself and your rights in relation to others. And that's what Calhoun means, that people can't be understood as individuals. They must be understood as social creatures.
Jim?
I'd like to ask a question to Mark. So a white man could acquire, could expand his rights. For example, a single white man could expand his rights by marrying, by having children, that is, by moving from one set of particulars to another, he would acquire a different set of rights?
He would acquire greater, and becoming, ultimately, of course, the power in the Old South ran through the slave plantation. So slaveholders also were at the top of that society. So the greater your responsibilities, the greater your rights. So you attained a fuller level of individuality, I guess you would argue, by having greater responsibilities in society and having you stood as a kind of Abraham over your that, this was the image that Southerners often used, a kind of Abraham over your children, your wife, your slaves, your other household dependents. So it was necessary, I think, in the South to be a white. It was necessary, but not a sufficient condition to be a white male.
Right. It almost sounds a little bit like that one acquires additional opportunities and maybe additional rights by acquiring additional property.
Yes. Yes, and the greater responsibility that that property entails. Yes, that's a fair assessment.
I would go up to, but not including that very last phrase.
What was the what are you objecting to?
Greater sense of responsibilities.
Well, greater responsibilities of property. To care for your property, including your property in man. Because with those rights and that web of social relations comes a greater responsibility to care for that property.
I see
not
that,
to abuse that property.
I see that with respect to persons. If I acquire a section of land, am I responsible for husbanding that land by proper logging and that sort of thing? Or do I have the right just to let it revert to nature? Am I some sort of a steward?
Well, if we're going to, what you were really asking is, do Southerners embrace the idea of bourgeois property, which gives you absolute right over your property? And that's a tricky question because they believe in free market. They believe in the ability to dispose of your property. They never sort this problem out completely. But the tendency, I think, is no. The answer is no. They reject or question the idea of bourgeois property. Now, again, we're in the realm of theory. We're not in the realm of what people actually did. And it's a much, much trickier problem for them than I'm suggesting. But I think I would answer you by saying no, they object to or reject the idea of bourgeois property, that you do enjoy absolute rights over your property. You do not. You have property brings with it certain responsibilities. And, of course, as I said, that includes property in man, which they acknowledge. Part of the answer that I would add to what I just said is that they don't believe you have absolute property in yourself. At least not everybody does, because that's the justification for slavery. You do not have absolute property in the self. And that's, of course, essential, I think, to the idea of individualism. That's not there in the South, or at least that's the tendency, that's the direction that society was going in as it worked out its social thought.
Well, see, our moderator is giving me the eye.
Yeah, I am giving you the eye. I actually kind of want to come back to this at some point to raise the very, very difficult question of whether an argument can be made that slavery was a more humane system than the systems that existed in the North. Okay. And Calhoun's going to make that argument, right? Okay. He and a couple of other people are going to write very persuasively about this. And it's a very interesting question and one that just seems so utterly wrong to the modern sensibility.
So we're moving on?
We are a little bit because there are people in the queue in front of you. And one of them is Tiffany. She's up next. She wanted to make a short comment.
I'm not terribly familiar with Calhoun's thought, so I'm hoping that somebody can kind of straighten this out for me. But I was a little bit confused by Calhoun and what exactly the source of our rights are, the source of government is. Because on the one hand, Mark's suggesting that it's our rights are determined by our station in society, that they are the product of this kind of web of relations, and that makes them sound positive. But yet he certainly seems to be appealing to at least some sort of understanding of a state of nature, even though he doesn't like a particular understanding of it. He appeals to a law of nature. He makes the argument that we are that man, and again, this sounds universal. Man is a political and social being. So I just wasn't clear exactly where nature and convention is sorted out in this, and what is the ground of these things.
Mark.
Just a small comment in answer to your question. Page 53 of Genovese's piece. And I think here your confusion about Calhoun's ambiguity is warranted. The paragraph that begins without blushing. Let me go to Le Texte, as our friend Kevin likes to say. Page 53, the paragraph that begins without blushing, and I won't read the entire thing to you. Genovese writes, Calhoun recognized natural rights when it suited him, but in such a way as to justify the suspicion that his definition reduced them to one of those abstractions he and his colleagues constantly protested against. To put it another way, He, in fact, denied the several doctrines of natural rights in vogue at the time. Political rights, he insisted, derive from the collective will of the society and are not natural. And I think that's where he ends up. And I think that's where the South eventually ends up, more or less in that position.
Okay, Jen and then Elaine.
So I'd like to suggest that this idea that, Calhoun is espousing is not different from any sort of conception of positive rights, actually. It's just one potential definition, right, of it. And so I think that this is a good time to bring in the challenge that if you don't have a natural rights conception of rights, and you have instead a positive rights conception, it doesn't in any way preclude a system of rights that is what many progressives or liberals would think of as being, you know, deleterious, right? So I think that it's a challenge to people who don't have a natural rights conception to understand that the possibility exists of having a rights system, if you are arguing for it yourself, in any way like this, is going to... This kind of thing is a potential of your own arguments, right? And this is really sort of an admonition to myself, because I'm not, I shouldn't say this out loud, but I'm not a natural rights person. So I sort of think that all rights are formed in society as well, right? But this is something that I have to remember when I'm thinking that, is it perhaps not okay to think of natural rights as a noble lie because they protect us from this?
Okay. Elaine.
My acquaintance with Calhoun comes largely from these readings. And I didn't actually see much of this in it in terms of a variation of what we in England might have called my station and its duties. But to the extent that it is there, because the main passages on equality are in the bits, pages... 42 onwards, the very end of the Calhoun section. And he's talking about the inequalities and the like, and he's talking about natural inequality, and he's talking about the ways in which these are a natural outcome of liberty and also sometimes a precondition of them. And that doesn't automatically seem to me to lead to these other conclusions. But one way in which one might make sense of it is to remember that one of the major analyses of rights divides them up into liberties, powers, immunities, and claims. And understood in these different ways, it might be possible for these to be rendered consistent. So, for example, it is certainly the case that, taking it the other way around, by acquiring certain sorts of property, I acquire certain sorts of rights and claims and duties. So if I buy a condo, I certainly then liable to certain duties in respect of my fellow condominium association owners. I'm obliged not to have large dogs and to water the lawn or whatever it may be. I also acquire certain claims upon them. I can require them not to make loud noises after 10 o'clock. There are various things that I can do as a result of having acquired property, and these have nothing to do with what government imposes upon me. Similarly, if I acquire a motor car, I am then obliged to do certain things about it that I wouldn't if I didn't actually take that step. So it may be that that kind of reasoning could be interpolated into this to try and make sense of some of these apparent inconsistencies. But insofar as one's talking about inequality per se being incompatible with libertarianism, far from it. The whole point about the libertarian view, as I understand it, where it has to do simply with limitations on coercive force by governments or others, is that it protects and enables inequalities of various sorts to play out. Now, the fact that the consequences of that may be displeasing to many is irrelevant.
Hayek has a really nice section on that question of egalitarianism in constitutional liberty, where, I mean, he's as certainly as libertarian as I think you can get, and yes.
Well, can I also make two other very, very brief historical points? These are very, very live issues. Sedition is part of the European plan. Sorry, there are laws against sedition in parts of the European Union. and in parts of the treaties that would combine states into a more perfect union. And secession is also a serious problem.
What's up? We've got Charlie.
Mark, I was just going to comment on Tiffany's question. Mark pointed to the exact excerpt that I was going to point to. It just occurred to me as I was reading this that I beg the same question, Tiffany, of where Calhoun is deriving his understanding of rights in this latter station approach. And the only answer I can come up with was from Calhoun. I have the same question.
Okay. Kevin.
Yeah, I want to try to tie Calhoun into what Mike asked earlier about writing down general rules. So Calhoun says on 24 and 25 or so, he's worried about written constitutions. And he says, you know, some people think written constitutions are just good and that they're sufficient, too, to kind of guarantee themselves somehow. And he says, you know, that this is kind of an idea in vogue. It's an error, he says, right? There's another error whose influence contributes. So is it a good idea, taking Hayek's ideas that laws, in the sense of rules, shouldn't change, and they should be as general as possible, right? They shouldn't be particular, because then you're they're by fiat, or you're messing around with commands. They're not rules anymore. But is it good to write down general rules? Is it better or worse to have a written constitution? You know, I tell my students sometimes, you know, philosophers and lawyers, I know this will shock you, but they try to twist what words mean, you know, and they interpret documents sometimes to their own ends. They're all horrified. They've never heard these things. They never thought about them, you know. So you have a U.S. Constitution. Is that better or worse at restraining government? Or will people find new powers there by combining amendments and all these very creative ways? And you can have a new chemical reaction and other these new rights, the right to an iPad or whatever it is that we'll find next, right? So I wonder if it would be better. Bledsoe quotes this. It's John Quincy Adams' Jubilee speech. For some reason, the date 1828 is sticking in my head, but that may be wrong. Someone can correct me, right? But this is on 141 of the Bledsoe, the very long Bledsoe. Long but short-winded in a way. I mean, I like some of the things he has to say, but he has this very kind of, as I do, right, long way of saying something, right? An elliptical way of working, right? So Adams says, the indissoluble link of the union is in the heart, right? It's not in the right. It's not in the heart. And if the people of the union decide to kind of leave, they should leave amiably and not fight each other. In other words, it's not in the written document of the Constitution that the union's constituted. It's in the hearts of the people that make it up. And I just wonder if you think about things like the English common law, if you think about things like traditions, if you think about things like common moral understandings, what Rawls calls comprehensive moral doctrines, right? Are those better safeguards than written words when the meanings of words change, when, you know, interpretations can become willful, when documents that are supposed to act as safeguards just become empowering documents to expand? Look, it's in the Constitution, right? It's constitutional, you know? So I think Mike is right to even ask this question. Can you write down general rules? Is it problematic to write down these general rules, or should they somehow be inscribed elsewhere, sedimented in traditions or something like that?
Elaine?
It would be lovely if they could indeed be inscribed in the hearts and minds of men and stay there. One of the arguments I used to have with Oakeshott was precisely about the written constitution. He almost had me persuaded that it was better defended by the traditions of England. He would have turned over in his grave to see that within a decade they had given up the hard won over many, many centuries liberties of Englishmen.
So now to the simple question in the closing moments: did the South have the right to secede?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Best answer so far of the day. Seriously, are you persuaded that the South had the right to secede? And one other question on top of that, and this is sort of related to things we're going to be talking about tomorrow too: had the South been able to secede, if the North had not enforced their inability to secede by, you know, by attacking them and saying, you will come back in, could the United States have achieved the sort of superpower status that it has today? Would we be standing atop the world as a virtual hegemon if it had not been for this? Yeah. That'd get you.
Of course. On your first question, I think, yes, on the historical argument, the South is persuasive, I think, about the nature of the Union and the formation of the Constitution, which grants the states rights to leave the Union. Now, of course, the success of secession was tested elsewhere, and the South failed that test. Your counterfactual question about the future of the United States is an interesting one. I don't know that I can answer it definitively. That's a polite way of saying I don't know the answer. But I know that European powers, England in particular, was delighted to see the Union threatened precisely for that reason, that it would weaken the United States. Though the United States would remain very strong, certainly it would be weaker vis-a-vis the other nations of the world. And France had a vested interest in Southern success because once the South failed, the French position in Mexico became untenable. If the French were to remain in Mexico, and they were having trouble doing that anyway, the Mexicans were weighing in on that. But it was tied to Southern success because the Confederates could have made common cause with them on that question, and the United States, of course, did not tolerate it and voiced their displeasure at Southern presence so close to the American border. So certainly the Europeans saw it that way and thought, this may not be a bad idea. The earlier, 20 years before the Civil War, the British were cultivating Texas. When Texas could not gain easy admission to the Union for a variety of reasons, the British were perfectly happy to cultivate relations with Texas and even encourage the Texans to expand further into the Southwest to create a future barrier to American expansion for just the same reason.
Jim.
On your first question, I say yes, because as we know, there are some contracts that are issued in perpetuity. There were, I think in Canada, perpetual bonds. And there are mineral rights that are granted in perpetuity. I think there's nothing in the Constitution, I think, that says that those signers have committed themselves in perpetuity. So I would say yes to that question. Second question, abstracting from military might, I think that geographical size is not well correlated to strength. You could compare the Soviet Union with its vast resources, material resources, and compare that to a place like England or Hong Kong or
Holland,
Historically. Yes. So I think it's the nature of the economic organization and property rights and culture that determines strength, not vast size or resources.
In fact, my question wasn't so much about the unification of the size of it, but more in terms of could the United States do what it has done if not for things like the 14th Amendment? This is the crux of the issue. Do we become strong because we expand federal power?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's where I'm headed with this. And it's not an easy question. And I don't like expanded federal power. I'm just pointing out that there is an argument to be made that maybe it's one of the reasons why we are where we are. And I'm sure that a lot of progressives would make that argument if we only had them here on this panel. Mike.
I just had a quick question. I always ask for the reciprocal of the question. So can the U.S. dump a state if we don't like it? I don't want Hawaii.
Are you kidding? Have you been there?
To defend it than having
it's really
it,
right? Nice.
Way out there. So get rid of Alaska and Hawaii. It'd be much cheaper to defend the U.S. And can we do that? I don't know.
It's a nice naval base, too. Well, we can chat about that. Bob, Grant.
Yeah, I will take the side that they did not have the right to secede, and all of these arguments are completely dishonest that I read in this packet today. First of all, there is a reference in the Constitution to the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. So they thought they were binding the future. They didn't quite say in perpetuity, but they did think that they were binding future generations. And the whole Blaisdell piece is a completely dishonest argument that claims that nothing happened in 1787 to 1789 when we wrote and ratified the U.S. Constitution superseding the U.S. the Articles of Confederation. He basically has to argue nothing happened as a result of our second Constitution, which is completely dishonest. And then one argument which is missing from the whole debate, which I learned from Orestes Bronson, who wrote this book, The American Republic, and that is that all of the states after the original 13 were essentially created from territories which were originally part of the national government. So in a sense, the national government was the mother of all of the states beyond the original 13. And you could argue that even those 13 states under the Continental Congress already had a sense of the kind of the legal unity. I just find all of these arguments kind of disingenuous hindsight rationalizations I'll call myself a Hamiltonian in the sense which I believe he was, which is a kind of a nationalist, and that the legal and historical arguments are much stronger for that position than the secessionist nullification position.
Kep.
Yeah, I mean it's a tough question, right? I mean, it's a metaphysical point about the nature of the union. I mean, is the union constituted by a contract among individuals in the aggregate, as Lincoln and Story say, or is it a compact, as people like Montesquieu say, or St. George Tucker, or between sovereign entities like the EU, right? So, in other words, sovereign territories contracting among themselves to make a compact. I mean, that's not a facile metaphysical difference, right? And if it's presumed on principle, right, and I believe with good faith by people like Lincoln and Story, that if it's presumed on principle that the United States is a contract among individuals in the aggregate, then it does look disingenuous for people like Calhoun or St. George Tucker or Spencer Roane or Abel Upshur or any of these other people to talk about a compact between sovereign bodies, right? I mean, it just looks silly. On the other hand, I mean, if you look at documents like the Treaty of Paris and stuff like that, I mean, these things are listed as, it looks like in international law, they're listed as Massachusetts plantation is listed as a sovereign territory. I mean, and it's not as if by abolishing the Confederation, we just go back to this Hobbesian state, right? I mean, it's not obvious immediately anyway that that's what happens, that all society is totally dissolved and that we're just living wild until we ratify the Constitution. I mean, if anything looks dishonest, it's a portrait like that that doesn't give kind of credit to the self-government of people that's already going on, right, and need a federal head to make it legitimate. I mean, these are real societies, you know. So, I mean, I don't really have a strong opinion. I mean, it's just, I'm a philosopher. I'm interested in the nature of things, and I'll just say that it seems to look equally ridiculous from each side, depending on which moral postulate you hold to dearly, right? I mean, if you believe that these are sovereign territories, then Lincoln just looks absurd, right? But if you believe that we're just running loose in the state of nature, then of course Bledsoe and these people look absurd, right? So it's just the importance of the starting point, I guess I would emphasize, right? Facts do not speak for themselves. So.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to ask you to hold off because we got questions here, so from the audience.
Hi, my name's Graham Gormley. I had more of a comment than a question, but through this whole discussion I've been reminded of Lincoln on this, and I was thinking, as far as I understand his position, he was well aware of the right of secession, so to say, but the reason he was opposed to the South seceding was that it was on unjust grounds. To spread slavery was not a just excuse for secession. And to use his metaphor of the apple of gold framed in the frame of silver, he was willing to, he says it's in some fragment, I don't recall which, he was willing to throw away the frame if it was for the preservation of the apple. Maybe he doesn't quite use those words, but that's the gist. And the apple is the declaration, the Declaration of Natural Law that all men are created equal. I was wondering if some of you could comment on that.
Go ahead, Trick.
Yeah. No, I think as Marx said earlier, Lincoln did not think secession was legal, apart from the content of, or the reason. He didn't think it was a legal right. So I guess.
Okay. Pamela?
Well, just to speak to this, the question of the unjust grounds, one of the things that I was thinking with respect to your second question, Mark, about what would we be today if we had allowed secession to occur, I am very persuaded by Lincoln that we would not be able to regard ourselves as a just society or a free one if we had permitted secession to occur.
Interesting. Thomas.
I'd like to further the debate between about Calhoun's conception of where rights come from, and my question is, you're talking about the difference between from where rights are derived and the nature of convention, the distinction between the two. But my question is, can you draw such a stark distinction between the two, or are the extent and particulars of the rights dependent on the cultural endowment? I guess one example that I'm thinking of is you were talking about sort of natural rights in the abstract, but if you look at something like the war in Iraq, where we're trying to bring rights to the people, there isn't a cultural endowment to support those rights. So my question is, can you really draw such a strong distinction between natural rights and convention, or do you think convention buttresses the extent of rights that people have?
Go ahead, Elaine.
I think, again, it depends on what you mean by rights. The only natural right that I would argue for here is the right of non-interference, that is to say, the right not to be coercively interfered with by others. The way in which that then plays out and what subsidiary institutions might be called upon to make that operational will depend a lot on the different societies. Now, I'm not talking about a natural right to vote. I'm not talking about a natural right to participate in any kind of democratic institutions. I'm not talking about any of those institutional rights which are very often referred to as natural rights and certainly come out in the Bill of Rights. So I think that's one way of dividing this up, in that the way to protect those rights may vary tremendously. And certainly the kinds of institutional frameworks that will help to promote and preserve them will vary a lot depending on the populations. And it is certainly the case that the presuppositions that were taken for granted by the framers of the U.S. Constitution are ones that would not necessarily hold good in many other societies. So insofar as what the U.S. government is trying to do is to do things like promote democracy, that I think is a much dodgier operation than trying to protect rights.